nostalgia.
Right. Yep. Welcome to Popping Collars, the podcast that lives in the space between meaning and culture. My name is Greg Knight. I am the director of children and youth ministries at the Church of Bethesda by the Sea in Palm Beach, Florida. With me is Betsy Gonzalez. Betsy, where are you? What are you up to?
I am in Alexandria, Virginia. It is exam week here at the Episcopal High School where I serve as the head chaplain.
Buckle down, kids.
Buckle down.
Read those
Get
books.
Ready.
That's right. Woo. Liz Easton. Liz, where are you? What do you do?
Hey, Greg. I am in Omaha, Nebraska, where it's currently 20 degrees, but it feels more like zero. And I'm the canon to the ordinary for the Diocese of Nebraska.
Somewhere in middle America. And our special guest for this episode is Sarah Noel Sweeney. Sarah, where are you? What are you up to these days?
I'm in Houston, Texas. And I'm a CPE supervisor and chaplain at St. Luke's Hospital.
This is our 51st episode, and the topic today is Westworld, a television series on HBO inspired by the 1973 film of the same name about a futuristic theme park populated by artificial beings. So fair warning for those who are joining us for the first time in our season three premiere episode. We do go into spoiler territory, so if you want to catch up before listening to us, please do so, and then check back in. Okay, an easy question to get us started. Fess up, which one of you guys is a robot? Who's the robot?
We wouldn't know, right?
So Liz asked an amazing question during our Star Wars episode, which was, what are droids? Like, are they people? Are they things? Okay. Are they like a smartphone? Are they like a butler? Like, what are they? And I feel like
are they slaves?
Question,
are they slaves?
Are they slaves? Right. I feel like that right. same question can be asked of Westworld. Like, what are these things? Are they robots? Are they, like, what are they?
Well, we see them treated in all different kinds of ways, right? I find, like, in particular, the nudity really interesting. You know, that people get berated for, like, covering them. We dehumanize the body. You know, Ta-Nehisi Coates' book, Between the World and Me, talking about race relations in the U.S., it's about the violation of the black body. That your body is not your own to completely control. And so it feels like with the bodies of these people, you know, don't cover them up. Just walk them around. Everything's fine. There's this vulnerability about them inside the nudity that also kind of can objectifies them.
And it's all glass walls. That they work in too. So it's like, you're never sort of hidden. There's never like a moment where you're not exposed.
And is that about the host or is that about the humans who care for the hosts?
The nudity is really interesting in that part of it to me, that when they're in like the kind of lab environment, they're not wearing any clothes because you would think that they look especially human when they're naked. This is not like a Ken doll or a Barbie doll, but it is like the ultimate, objectification, like that by stripping them, then it makes them somehow respond to them as being less human.
Mm. Yeah.
It seems like their nudity makes them more vulnerable and makes us see them more vulnerable than we would if they were enclosed in those glass boxes. Right. So it probably endears them to us somehow, or because it's so shocking that they're totally exposed that way. Someone pointed out to me that as Maeve's consciousness continues to increase, she continues to be more clothed and we don't see her naked anymore.
And more clothed in not her character clothing, but she goes from wearing that to the lab tech, you know, that latex to then clothes. And she can blend in with everybody else. Right. Like that's an interesting evolution. And she starts off kind of being really powerful as that madam character. And then she becomes very vulnerable as the mom and then she's kind of coming into this power again in that black suit at the end. Like my Bib Theo class, the big joke with my sophomores is, you know, it's not like Sunday school where when in doubt, answer Jesus. You know, in my class, it's when in doubt, say it's about creation. You know, water comes up, it's about creation, you know, whatever. But that, you know, the kids really, when we talk about the Adam and Eve story and the nudity that they're experiencing before the fall, that there's that element happening in here too, that is there this naivete, this innocence, this whatever it is in the nudity, particularly with Maeve. And then as she, let's just say, as she ups her profile, eats from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, and then suddenly, you know, she's clothed. And that we're playing around inside that creator created relationship that's happening between Ford and the hosts and Arnold and the hosts, right? Mm-hmm. That, and there you even are dealing with that omniscient voice that's kind of around and in, but it's that element of God and creator as kind of being transcendent or immanent. You know, is God, is the creator at a distance watching the creation kind of happen and do its thing? Or is the creator, you know, pulling you aside into little rooms for chats so we can talk about things, or strolling about in the park with you occasionally? You know, that's, there's very much this biblical creation thing that's being played out at the same time as well.
You know, when it opens on a naked body, you're like, oh, it's an HBO show. Of course it has to open on a naked body.
Of course.
It can't, you know, can't not open on a naked body, but it's like, it's a lot of sitting nudity.
I kept wondering if they were cold. You know, like,
well, they're in cold storage, right? I think that was part of it for me. I was like, ugh.
Yeah, right. Crazy. Did you kind of sit on a stool? It's just, I do not, you don't look good that way. No one looks good that way. Everybody go home. Right, just sit on a stool naked in front of your mirror, a real exploratory moment for yourself, perhaps.
Consciousness raising right here. No one looks good naked.
No one looks good naked. That's why there aren't mirrors directly in front of toilets. No one, PSA. No one looks good naked like that. That's hard.
I started the conversation asking if you guys were robots, but one of the things that I think that the show does really well, kind of moving on from nudity a little bit, but one of the things that that it really sells you on is the idea that the hosts operate in these narrative loops. And the way that you experience these characters are going to be familiar because they present the same scenarios for all of the visitors that come into the park. You know, the more that the season plays along, at first it's kind of like, you know, a little jarring because you're like, you just get the sense that it's kind of like Groundhog Day in this park, that everybody's kind of living the same day. But then you start to recognize that, no, it's more kind of a general job that you do, that you're kind of living in. So the bandit is always a bandit, you know, every day. And Maeve is always the madam every day. And it's the way that you pull yourself out of these loops is how the robots kind of attain consciousness. And, mm-hmm. you know, I just sort of see, I see human beings that I work with falling into loops all the time. Like after watching the show, I sort of thought to myself, well, I kind of have a loop. Like I drive the same way to work every day. And then I, you know, I eat like the same lunch every day and I do this the same every day. And it's like, you start to recognize that there's something kind of comforting about patterns in life, but then there's also something kind of trapping.
Yeah. We have scripts.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, I think, yeah, family systems theory would say that too, that, basically our goal is to make everything be the same, even when we consciously don't want it to be, or we've decided that there's more to it. Basically we want things to stay the same. There's a giant force in us to try to keep it the same, and in our groups as well.
Mm-hmm. Sarah, as someone who works as a chaplain at a hospital, so I work in a parish context, Betsy's at a school, Liz is on the highways and byways of Nebraska, a bunch of different passions, but your context has to be pretty unique. I mean, because it's got to be different every day. Like you never know like who you're going to meet, who's going to get discharged, who's going to be admitted. Like it's just a different population all the time. Right.
Yes.
So it's harder to sort of fall into those kind of ministry patterns, it seems like, or is
yes
it?
And no. I think there can be, for medical staff, there can be a dehumanizing aspect to their work. They've been a nurse for 20 years, they have their drill. They treat everybody pretty much the same. They go on autopilot. It helps them actually cope with the amazing amount of suffering and tragedy that they're encountering on a daily basis. So we, you know, part of what we do is are kind of attentive to that compassion fatigue or burnout that leads to some of that numb autopilot in medical staff. But yeah, I would say for the patient population, their loop has pretty much stopped. Their loop has been totally interrupted. And so they're grappling hard with that reality that, yeah, we might be bored or on autopilot or kind of talk about the mundane. They're like really, they would love to go back to that when I encounter them in the hospital, right? They would love to go back to the normal life, the loop.
Yeah. I had never thought about it that way as what you just described, Sarah, of their loop being interrupted. And I would imagine that that happens with a hospitalization, but also with grief, you know, a major loss in your life. Anytime that there's this sort of breaking through, there's sort of a trauma associated with even just not just the loss itself, but that act of being shaken out of your loop for whatever it's. I had never thought about that before. In quite and that way.
And the hospital itself is very dehumanizing. So you do become very objectified and people are allowed to touch your body or move your body or subject your body to whatever they kind of decide needs to happen. And you're along for that ride. And it, especially in a major medical institution, like a major research institution, like you've signed up for the best in whatever this is. So like the best cardiologist, for instance. I just did the memorial service for Denton Cooley, did the first artificial heart transplant in the US in the 60s. Just did his memorial service today. And it's like, if he was your doctor, he got to do whatever he wanted to do. And you were grateful. And you would never like say anything other than how lucky you are to have him. But that means he gets to do whatever he wants. And you're kind of along for the ride. So if you decide you don't want to do any more interventions, and this happened all the time with people who had heart transplants, they would come back to the hospital, another round of interventions, another round of intensive therapies. If at some point you decide you don't want to do that anymore and he's not ready to let that go, then you don't get to like get off the train. So,
wow. Yeah. I remember that from having a baby, you know, that my body and that element of being laying on the table and having a C-section. And having my body, I can't even feel my body below a certain, and I know my body is moving around because I can't see, but I know. And it's like, I am not in control, Mm-hmm. And that feels really terrible.
Yeah. It seems like there could be a kind of spiritual, I mean, there's a spiritual opportunity there, you know, going through an experience like that. But also, I could imagine a spiritual crisis over that. Maybe even especially if you're a person who is especially embodied. You know, I think that some people are essentially kind of live a dualistic life. They don't really feel their feelings that well, and they are more up in their head, and they don't really think about their body.
And that it's interesting watching the characters on the show. You know, we talk about their bodies, but they're really trying to connect with their minds. They're really trying to connect with this consciousness or this voice or this whatever it is that's driving them forward or causing them to seek, like Dolores, you know, that she's just seeking and seeking and seeking in a way that and she gets to places and she just can't remember, you know, and that she's done this before, the seeking. And I find her character probably, I don't know, archetypally the most interesting because we're also playing around with archetypes here. You know, it's loops and scripts, but she's the damsel in distress. Like that's her archetype. She's going to drop that can and some sweet boy's going to pick it up and we're going to be off doing whatever, you know, and are you going to save her dad when you roll up to the house and he's being robbed? Teddy is another really interesting character to me in terms of his struggle, and is he the good guy, but he's also has seen himself as the bad guy too. That all of that, those two things I find really interesting in terms of the hosts. You know, Tandy Newton's got her own really intense thing going on, but that Dolores Teddy thing, whatever they're trying to kind of, that level they're trying to reach, that's been kind of suggested to them, implanted in them a little bit.
Yeah, I agree. I think the Dolores and Teddy are extra tragic to me because they're not trying to get out and they're trying to get in even farther into this world that has like programmed them to do all different kinds of things and play all different kinds of roles, good guys and bad guys, since the start of the park, and have voices implanted in them that send them on these wild discoveries so that Arnold, I guess, right, can figure out if his theory is true. And they're prey to this, and she's seeking and seeking, you know, like Maeve is seeking and seeking to get out, and like I'm associating that with liberation and freedom and autonomy and all these kinds of American values, right? But Dolores is trying to get even farther into it, and I the whole time just kept thinking, like, why are we going farther into this?
Farther into it by journeying away from all the things that are comfortable and familiar. So what I loved about Dolores's journey into the wilderness, which I mean, that's really what it was. She left town. She left home. She left her blue dress, her rancher blue dress behind. And she goes on this journey of discovery. It just makes me think that there are these moments that I find myself in life anyway. And I think a lot of people do where, and I think you touched on it, Sarah, this idea of the hospital moment where you're on autopilot, but something shakes you out of it and you're able to kind of see your life from a different perspective a little bit, you know, not necessarily from ground level, but you're able to kind of see, oh my gosh, like I fit into this piece of a puzzle. You know, I feel like maybe there's a little bit more purpose here or something. You know, you have these glimpses of what your life could possibly be.
Do you think, though, that the people who visit the park are really struggling with that? I thought it was really interesting that one of the taglines in, like, the Westworld promotional material was discover your true calling. And what it seems like people are doing when they visit there is really indulging in sin, you know, to use a religious word, or hedonism or whatever. Like, I kept thinking, like, what would I do if I went to Westworld? Because I've always been kind of fascinated with time travel, and it's such a kind of rich invitation. So if people are there to supposedly discover their true calling, what they're really doing is shooting people and screwing. That's it.
But that feels like the surface engagement. And maybe it's what the man in black, what William is leading us to, is that, oh, well, there's this deeper thing that's actually going on here. Right. I like your connotation and talk about the wilderness, Greg, you know, and in that biblical sense of the rawness, the kind of, and for the people visiting the park, it's getting away from, because we still don't even know what the world looks like outside of the park. But the idea of getting out to the edges of the park is where there's true discovery. That motif comes up not only for Teddy, but also for Dolores. And she paints the picture and there it is. It's real, this place that, you know, or the place where the ocean meets the sea, or the place where, you know, whatever sort of vaguely Mexican town name everything kind of seems to have in this world. But out there, and that same way for the Israelites, and that same way for John the Baptist and for desert fathers and mothers and all of that, they getting out into the wilderness is a place of being closer to your creator, closer to the divine. And the further out Dolores goes, the more she's in touch with Arnold, the more they're connected to one another. That sort of idea. And I think that the idea for the man in black is he's seeking for what he's connected to, because he's become so disconnected in his life. And he's seeking that, maybe something greater, anything, because the rest of life feels so empty.
Well, he's doing something different than everyone else. Like he's yes. playing Westworld like a video game. Really, like he's trying to get to the next level.
He's trying to level up. What's the next big boss right. that I have to get by to get to the next level of this game?
Right, and other people are sort of playing games within games, I guess.
Like you're right, it is. It's like video game theory. It's like an addiction. He got hooked on World of Warcraft, and he can't leave. Right?
Yeah,
like that's pretty much it. And you know, the thing that you said, Liz, about like, well, is this what people do? They just go to this park and they shoot and screw. And I think that what you're describing is how Ford sees the park.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, his whole point by the end of the series is that, well, if this is all humanity's about, then what are we even talking about here? It's not, I mean, we create this amazing world, and all humans do is come here and shoot each other and shoot hosts and screw around, and they don't take any of this seriously, and they don't see the beauty of any of it. And mm-hmm. so he's just going to hit a big reset button on the whole thing. I mean, it's a flood story just with robots, right?
Agreed.
And Ford is God in this scenario. And it's, and you know, the thing is, like, the way that Ford talks on the show and that sentiment, it sounds a lot like a burned out priest or burned out, like a burned out social worker or something. It sounds like somebody that's like, you know what? God, like every day I just deal with crap and I'm so sick of it. I'm just the reset button on this whole thing. Like, you know,
Right. I've done all that I can. You're not living up to my expectations of what this is supposed to look like.
Well, and it seems like this is not, it's not the first time, you know, that kind of burned out floor with the lights and the stuff. This is not the first time we've hit the reset button on this little franchise, right?
Right. They have ruins, basically.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Previous stories are ruins. And, and that floor is weird. And what's going on there? You know, I wrote down this note while watching the final episode. I wrote, suffering is the key to experience.
Yeah.
Suffering is the key to freedom. That idea of, well, let's burn up in this tent together so we can go, you know, I need to be shot and killed so that I can then get to this next place of freedom. That suffering, I think, not only for the human beings in the story, but for the hosts, that there's an element of suffering as a door to freedom.
I got really nervous about that part. I was like, okay, we have to treat that idea really carefully, right? Not just in Westworld, but like in general.
In life in general. I mean, and I think about in your world, you know, that people have all kinds of narratives around suffering and you know, the odyssey of how I've ended up in this place.
For what purpose?
Right.
And but we also do know resilience theory does tell us that people are stronger when they've had to overcome something. Mm-hmm. But that's not necessarily the same thing as we all have to suffer so that we can be really human. Like, we can take that pretty soon. That's like really cruel, actually, and more objectification. I'm nervous about how if that idea keeps running as a thread through the show, I'm kind of like, ooh, because... And I thought it's helpful to hear that it was suffering. In my mind, I had stored that line or that idea as trauma. Ford had said something about trauma. Mm-hmm. And the thing about that is you can't make meaning of trauma, at least not right away. There is an aspect of meaninglessness in trauma. So it'll be interesting to me to see how the show, if the show continues to work with that idea, are they paying attention to things like trauma theory, which tell us that with at least certain traumas and at least for a certain amount of time, we won't be able to easily fold it into the narrative of our life that gives us meaning.
Mm-hmm. Well, I find the pictures really interesting. You know, whenever they show a host a photo or something that's out of their context, I don't see anything.
Mm-hmm. You know, it doesn't look like anything to me.
Like that, we had a candidate come and visiting, interviewing to be a chaplain here, and he did a meditation, which was great. This guided meditation and kind of around wilderness actually and Advent and you know, someone arrives and you know, someone who you know very well and love and hands you an envelope and you open it up and it has a picture in it. What's in your picture? And there's several of us who watch Westworld in the chapel. Our first thought was, it doesn't look like anything to me. And I'm like, oh no, it's gotten into my head. Oh.
You got a gun, Politi? Or will you use mine?
I'm a straight shooter, never lose a gun, so went to school to learn how to be cool. Hands in a holster, where's the jam? You gonna be toaster, be a can ham. I was bone tough, rough, but that wasn't enough. Now I got the stuff to make your knees shake, headache, ground quake, and legs break. 44 drone in my sunglasses on. Take a good look, you're gonna be the last crook who even took a glass. Don't even have a chance after that. Roll like a cedar and bite like a bat. Splat, your face screams.
Sorry, you go.
So Liz, you have our very first employee pick for the new season of Popping Collars. So what's your pick? What is something that you would like to introduce us to and spread the word of?
This is Greg's idea from, like, when you go in the Blockbuster, if you all know what Blockbuster was, you can look it up on Wikipedia, and there would be a shelf right?
Mm-hmm.
Where the employees would put out their video pics, mm-hmm. and you'd be like, ooh, I always love what.
Right. And Brett would always have like blockbuster movies, but Joan would have little known independent movies.
Right.
And you would always pick a Joan movie.
Right. So this is our version of that.
I love it.
So Joan, I mean, Liz, yeah. What is your first?
I've been listening to this podcast called My Favorite Murder. Have you guys listened to this?
Oh, I have listened to My Favorite Murder.
Oh, yeah. No, I haven't. What is it?
Oh, it's pretty awesome. It's like the number one ranked comedy podcast right now. It's ranked, it's categorized as comedy, although a lot of times it's not funny, but it's two women who are great comedians and writers and friends in real life who also happen to be sort of true crime buffs. And what you sort of I also am kind of into true crime, and a lot of people are, as it turns out, especially women. I think that it's sort of a coping mechanism for living in a dangerous world that women get sort of obsessed with some of these true crime stories. But anyhow, these two friends just sit down and they talk about their favorite murder every week. It's just, they tell the story of a different murder, and it's really, really dark. It's very funny. And it's pretty, it can be off-putting, like, because sometimes they feel sort of flip when they're talking about people's murders. But what they sort of continually say is that they are very anxious people. And this is one way that they cope with their anxiety, is to sort of get really obsessed about what they're afraid of. Anyway, it's been really interesting. It feels kind of like having a private, listening in on a private conversation of two great friends, you know, two people who are great friends with each other and are really funny. Yeah. And if you're at all into like reading Wikipedia articles about Ted Bundy or something, you'll probably be into My Favorite Murder.
This sounds like it's right up my alley. I'm looking over their website. This is really interesting.
It's pretty crass. I mean, it's vulgar, and it's dark. There are
I love a good true crime documentary. Watch the Amanda Knox one on Netflix. Oh my goodness,
that was a great one. Ooh. Yeah, it's all that stuff.
So I found My Favorite Murder through the Cracked podcast. They had him on guests on the Cracked podcast one time, and very funny. And in one of the episodes, they talked about professional wrestling, because there was a murder in the world of professional wrestling, and that
And Georgia's husband has a professional wrestling podcast.
I wrote a special blog post for our website that was about professional wrestling, because I didn't want to subject you guys to a conversation.
That was a great article. That was a great one.
You can find Popping Collars on the web at poppingcollarspodcast.com. You can find us on Facebook, facebook.com/poppingcollars, and you can find us on Twitter at Popping Collars. You can also find us on Instagram, where we have an account and we post photos every now and then. And we have a Spotify playlist. All of this stuff is on our website. So just go to our website. You can find the links to all of these things. Also, we ask that you subscribe, rate, and review our show wherever you get your podcasts. We're on iTunes, we're on Stitcher, we're on SoundCloud. So we're all over the place. You should be able to find us pretty easily. One of the places that we are is at the Episcopal Cafe. We love EpiscopalCafe.com. We know you will as well. Check them out for all your Episcopal news, needs, and beyond. And we are part of the Episcopal Cafe Podcast Network, which you can find at EpiscopalCafe.com/podcast. Please check out our partner shows, which are wonderful shows to listen to, in addition to My Favorite Murder. My Favorite Murder and then Two Feminists and the Bible. Back to back. That's awesome. Yeah. Good combo. Anyway, that is Popping Collars for this time. Thank you, Betsy. Thank you, Liz. Thank you, Sarah, for coming on the show. We will see you next time.
Keep those collars popped.
That's right. Keep them popped.